Hi there, I'm K-Town, and on this edition of Mysterious Radio.
You know, I've always been interested in UFOs really since I was a kid. I've always thought they were fascinating. But then when I did my book called The Big Book of Mars, I started writing about them in one section of that book because there's a lot of belief in intelligent life on Mars in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And as UFOs started being spotted in the late 1940s, there were some who believed they may have been piloted by Martians. So I wrote about it a little bit in that book, but obviously there's so much more to the UFO story. I really wanted a chance to dive into it much deeper. And so working on We Are Not Alone gave me an opportunity to explore it from all different kinds of angles. And so you'll see in that book, it covers the UFO phenomena primarily from the 1940s up till right now, with a little bit of ancient history as well. And it gives it from perspectives of experiencers, abductees, scientists, historians, a little bit of everyone in between.
And I want to go back to what you said and about the Martians piloting those. Did you find that? I mean, did a researcher say that, or where did you get that idea?
Oh, there were army officials who thought they may be piloted by Martians.
Really?
There's a lot of belief in Martians back then. And that went from all kinds of brilliant minds in the early 1900s. You had people like, you know, Nikola Tesla, Marconi, heads of Harvard and scientists at Amherst, who believed very much so that there was intelligent life on Mars and they might be trying to reach out to us and trying to devise ways to receive their signals and trying to find ways to send them signals and find some way to communicate. So these thoughts went on for decades into the 1900s. By the 40s, those thoughts were starting to wane, and there was more belief that there was probably not intelligent life on Mars. But there were still those who believed. And so when people started seeing UFOs in the 40s, there were those who thought they might be from Mars. And part of the thinking there was, you know, coming out of World War II, we're entering the atomic age, you know, with the atomic bomb. And so there's a thought that our neighboring planet, Mars, might be affected or feeling threatened by what's going on here on Earth, that nuclear weapons might actually start to affect the solar system and the planets around us. So that was some of the thinking of why maybe these were Martians coming to investigate what was going on here on Earth or from other planets as well.
Yeah. Do you believe that there are intelligences living upon Mars right now?
Just our robots. But I do think that,
okay,
which is ours, but I do think that we can find life on Mars. It would just be microbial beneath the surface. And actually in that book, The Big Book of Mars, I wrote about one of the experiments done on the Viking mission in the 1970s, where the test on both Viking landers did show positive results for life on Mars. And those experiments were never repeated. And NASA didn't want to acknowledge that data because they believed it may have been an exotic chemical reaction as opposed to a biological reaction. But when I spoke with the experimenters who ran it, they were completely convinced that their data was accurate. And it does seem quite possible that underneath the surface, where you get away from the solar radiation, that life could exist there. We know that there's water beneath the surface and ice, and so you have the ingredients for life to exist. And we see it here on Earth. You know, we see life existing in mine shafts, you know, a mile beneath the surface where the sun never reaches, and life finds a way to still exist. So once I think we can explore a little bit more beneath the ground, I suspect we will find something. And elsewhere too in the solar system, even like Europa, which is one of the moons of Saturn, we might find life beneath the ice there. I mean, they have massive oceans beneath like a 10-mile sheet of ice, which is hard to even fathom how thick that is. But I think we'll find it.
What about the face, Mark? What about the face on Mars? You believe that was really a face? And then they came back and kind of said it was, you know, shadows and things like that. What are your thoughts about it?
I agree with the shadows. I think they eventually got better imagery of it, and it doesn't look as much like a face. So I think between light, shadows, and the pareidolia effect, where your mind kind of sees shapes and forms patterns that it understands, I don't think that was really an ancient civilization that made it.
All right. So let's talk about your book here. This is a really cool book, man. I mean, the cover I love. You got this cool green flying saucer on it. We Are Not Alone, The Extraordinary History of UFOs and Aliens Invading Our Hopes, Fears, and Fantasies, which is right. You can't get any writer than that. That is awesome, man. Okay, so tell me where, like, how far into the phenomenon did you look into? Just scratch the surface. Don't go into detail because I have a lot of questions for you. But did you look at, you know, everything from sightings to abductions in this book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I spoke to several people who claimed to have been abducted. I looked into historical cases of abductees. There was another group called the Contactees, who were people primarily in the 50s who believed that they had met people from other planets and visited their planets and on space, flew in their spaceships. We can talk more about that. And then I spoke with lots of scientists through SETI, you know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence outside of, you know, throughout the galaxy. So I spoke with people researching that. And I spoke with people who've been more recently or currently searching for extraterrestrial life. Avi Loeb, for example, with the Galileo Project from Harvard. And spoke with the people who worked on the New York Times article in 2017 that got the whole notion of the UAP out into the public, unidentified aerial phenomena, with the Navy pilots who saw these UAPs, the Tic Tac people, maybe your listeners have heard about. So all these sightings have happened in recent years by more credible witnesses, or I should say, at least, you know, people we believe are credible, Navy pilots and so forth. I dove into all that.
You know what? I stumbled up on a website somewhere that had like the letters. We're going to start talking about Kenneth Arnold, which is the first one in your book. But someone had archived all those letters, man, and they came from everywhere. Somewhere online is the archive, National Archive, where you can read the letters from all the people that wanted to know more information about what Kenneth Arnold saw during his flight. But for those that don't know what we're talking about, tell us what happened with him.
So Kenneth Arnold is kind of what the event that really began the modern UFO phenomena. He's actually the guy that led to the coining of the term flying saucer. So this began on June 24th, 1947. He was a pilot from Boise, Idaho, and he happened to be flying over the Washington state area. And he was looking for a downed plane. Just helping search the mountains. And as he's flying, it's middle of the afternoon, it's a nice summer day, and he sees this these nine shiny flat objects. They're kind of whizzing, they're weaving through the sky. It's like a chain-like formation. This is over Mount Rainier in Washington. And these are just bizarre. He's like, what am I seeing here? And they're moving very fast. He estimated they were moving at 1,200 miles per hour, which was beyond anything we can move at back then, at about 10,000 feet. And he didn't know what he was seeing. He didn't know if it was some kind of new experimental jet aircraft, guided missiles, maybe even geese. He really wasn't sure. But when he landed, he mentioned what he'd seen to some people. And word got out quickly. The press kind of swarmed to him and had so many questions for him. And he had mentioned that basically they moved. They look like saucers skipping on water. And that's when one of the reporters took that idea and called them flying saucers. And so, as I said in the book, neither our skies nor our vocabulary has ever been the same since. But that was really the first big sighting. And what's amazing is that right after that, there were sightings all across the country over the weeks that followed. Almost every state had sightings from people of these kind of flying saucers or something in the skies that they couldn't explain.
Do you know if there's any kind of archival footage of him being interviewed and actually speaking about it? Or I never could find anything where he was actually being interviewed and filmed talking about it.
You know, I don't remember coming across video of him. Lots of documents, okay. Lots of articles. He wrote his own booklet about the whole event. Lots of statements. So there's a lot of information. I honestly can't remember seeing any video.
Me either. I mean, you can tell a lot about a person and, you know, their believability, which I do believe him. If you just, you know, see them on camera or something, and I've never seen anything with him talking about it. Just, you write a ton of articles, everything, you know, drawings, the drawings are really unique too. Do you know if the subsequent sightings that were coming after he reported his, were people saying they saw the same type of craft, or were they different in shape?
There were a lot that were seeing similar types of craft. Yes, very saucer-like. That became sort of the thing. This saucer-like shape, flying discs was another term that they used. And that's what a lot of people claimed to see. And again, this was across the country. And granted, some of these ended up being hoaxes. Some of them were like bad hoaxes. But a lot of them, again, just kind of remained unidentified. And you had different people theorizing about what this might be. Obviously, they were trying to figure things out. You know, some people suggested that it was meteorological effects. Some people did think that they might be geese or even white swans, and that, you know, the size was just an illusion. So there were different theories of what it could be. But, you know, Kenneth Arnold, he wasn't saying, he never came out and said, I saw you, you know, something from another planet. He just didn't know what he saw. He just described what he'd seen and was convinced he saw what he saw. And that was that.
Yeah, very interesting, though. It's always, I love getting firsthand accounts from pilots, you know, because you want to, you know, they know what they're looking at. They know if they're looking at another plane or whatever. So those accounts to me are more credible. I want to go over to the Battle of Los Angeles now. Now that is incredible. There was another gentleman who has since died. I know you probably know who he is. William Tompkins. Have you seen his account? They videoed him.
No.
About what happened at the Battle of Los Angeles, and he was actually there.
Oh wow! No, I missed that.
Okay. Well, he became a high-ranking government contractor, and supposedly he worked closely with ETs for the government, but his account of what happened during that time, I mean, was just unreal. Now, let me start off by asking you, do you believe that they were really shooting at some type of alien craft?
I believe they were shooting at something. The photo is there. You see it. And it's really hard to know what it was. I don't know if it was an alien craft. I know it was something. So it's possible.
It was something that their shells couldn't bring down. And we know that there was nothing that could withstand that type of barrage of gunfire,
right,
and not come down. But whatever it was wouldn't come down.
It wouldn't come down. It drifted away and it came back. And it was tracked on radar. So I like it. As I mentioned in the book, it's one of the people I spoke with, a UFO researcher and historian named David Marler, calls it a genuine UFO, exactly what it stands for. It was an unidentified flying object, and, you know, quite possibly extraterrestrial. You know, was this the first major visitation? I mean, it's quite possible.
Do you know if anyone got killed during that time? I imagine shells were being shot everywhere, but you know if there were any fatalities from that incident?
There were. I don't know if they were directly from like shrapnel from the shooting, but there was a blackout that was ordered from Santa Monica to San Diego, which lasted 5 hours, and that led to 3 deaths, which were supposedly caused by accidents, and then there were 2 more from heart attacks. So, you know, connected to it, but I don't think it's like a result of the gunfire specifically.
Okay, so my listeners are going to be mad if I don't have you go into detail about this. So tell us what happened on that night that you have in your book here called The Battle of Los Angeles.
Yeah, so this was very early on, still like middle of the night, early morning, February 25th, 1942. So keep in mind, that's just a few months after Pearl Harbor and the United States got really pulled into World War II. And they see this strange object appearing over the Southern California coast. And like I said before, radar detected it. First detected at 1:44 a.m. So just kind of moving slowly south from Santa Maria towards L.A. And they opened up, they pulled out anti-aircraft guns, and they just started firing upon this thing. And I have a photo in the book. You'll see the gunfire kind of all convening on this one sort of central object. And they had air raid alerts going and spotlights converging on it. They fired up to 1,400 rounds of ammunition. So it's a lot, you know, and like I said, there's shrapnel kind of filling the sky and falling to the ground. But as you mentioned, it wasn't brought down at all. It just seemed to not care. It just kept moving and ended up moving along the coast towards Long Beach and then came back towards Santa Monica. And they had, you know, this was on CBS radio broadcast, talked about this. I'll read a quick quote from the book that the CBS broadcast said, "The guns went into action again, hurling round after round of shells at the object. The second barrage appeared to be closer to downtown Los Angeles, since watchers could hear the concussion of the guns more clearly and the flash of bursting shells was brighter. Then the ship disappeared for the second time over the ocean." So keep in mind, they didn't have terms like UFO or flying saucers back then. They didn't know what it was. They were shooting at something. They thought it may have been some sort of Japanese craft. Japanese subs had actually attacked an oil field just north of Los Angeles just 32 hours before that. So they thought maybe this was something, they thought this may have been something else from Japan. But the Japanese said that they had nothing like that after the fact. They said, no, this was not us in any way. Then there was a sort of contradictory messages coming from the Secretary of War and others from the government. Secretary of the Navy said it was the whole thing was a false alarm due to, quote, jittery nerves. And he said there were no planes over L.A. Meanwhile, the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, claimed that they were commercial planes, quote, operated by enemy agents to detect air defense positions and also to demoralize civilians, which, you know, seemed like that was happening. So there was just a lot of, I think, confusion and curiosity about what this was, and really no real explanation ever came out.
They didn't have a press conference or anything like that, that you know of?
Well, yeah, I think you got the press conferences from Frank Knox, the Secretary of the Navy, the one who called it the jittery nerves. That's when that would have happened. And then the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, you know, also commented on it. And then you had a member from Congress from California, Leland Ford, demanding an explanation and kind of mocking the explanations he'd gotten. He stated that the people of California are, quote, not jittery or hysterical, but are beginning to believe that the Army and Navy are. So again, what was going on? People want to know, and no explanations were given or just available.
So no one come forward, none of the locals come forward on camera to say, you know, yeah, what we saw wasn't normal. It was a craft and, you know, they couldn't bring it down or anything like that.
There were people who came forward and talked about, but they just didn't know what it was.
Do you know if there's archival footage of anything? I don't expect you to know everything like that, Mark, but I'm just wondering, have you ever seen anything like that where a citizen, I've looked actually, and I couldn't find anything. But I'm wondering if some exist. Do you know if something exists like that where someone was able to come forward on camera and say what they actually saw?
I haven't seen it on camera. Just comments, you know, comments in newspapers, writing in op-eds, that kind of thing, where people who witnessed it were discussing it. You know, one guy was saying, because there was talk about, like, is it a balloon, is the blimp? And that didn't make sense, again, because it would have come down if that was the case. Some people suggested writing in saying it may have been a meteorological phenomenon called ball lightning, but that doesn't quite make sense either, especially since it was being tracked by radar, and the way it moved also wouldn't really align with that. So again, it's just left as unknown. There's no, you know, actual answer to what this thing was, or at least confirmed answer.
Yeah, yeah. Man, your book's really good, man. You did a great job. I'd say, you know, I have a ton of books, and this is really good. All right, so I want to skip through and talk about this one here. This one is, you've got it. Let's see here. It says, a flying egg lands in, is that Socorro, yeah. New Mexico. Wow. Tell me about that, man. And this, tell me about this picture too. I mean, this is a recreation, but wow, this is great. Yeah. Tell us about that one.
The Socorro. So the picture you're referring to, I think, is the diorama. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is actually kind of cool. This has never been published before. I'll back up a second and describe what we're talking about. So the flying egg in Socorro, New Mexico. So keep in mind, this is happening. This is 1964. New Mexico is kind of a hotbed for UFO sightings and strange phenomena. This is, of course, most famous event there being Roswell in 1947. So this one's actually, fairly well documented as well. Socorro, New Mexico. This happened April 24th, 1964. And part of what makes it so interesting is the witness is a very credible witness. So you talked about pilots earlier being very credible, which I agree with, particularly these Navy pilots who are flying, billion-dollar aircraft and are trained and they know what they're seeing, right? This guy was a police officer who had a very solid reputation. He was well-liked. He was honest. This wasn't a guy that seemed to have any reason to make something up. And so he was chasing a speeding car outskirts of town. And he hears this explosion and sees a flame in the sky off to the side. So he at that point, he forgets this driver. He's not pursuing him anymore. He wants to see what's going on with this explosion. So he goes about half a mile up this hill, this hilly road, and he sees, just off the road about 150 feet in the gully, there's this egg-shaped object. And it's got these four girder-like legs emanating from it. And then he sees two people, as he described in white coveralls, humanoid figures, standing next to this vehicle, has no idea what this vehicle is, doesn't look like anything. It's got this weird red insignia on it. And, he starts approaching it, and then he hears another loud sound. He sees smoke shooting out from beneath it, and the egg goes up and flies off. So he has no idea what this thing is. He goes back to his car. He calls in for help, he calls in, on his radio and gets other law enforcement officers to come out to the scene. And they investigate and they can see indentations in the ground where he saw it. They can see kind of smoldering ground a little bit. The four depressions in the ground from those girder-like legs. And he describes what he saw. And again, no idea what this thing is. The FBI investigates it. J. Allen Hynek, who was the chief investigator for Project Blue Book, which was the Air Force's program to investigate UFO sightings, went out there and met with Officer Zamora, found him to be very credible, did not find a good explanation for what this was. And there have been several theories about it. They had Geiger detectors, by the way, detected no radiation. So again, there's lots of strange facts about this case. But there is an Air Force base nearby called Holloman Air Force Base. And that day, they were conducting tests at the north end of the White Sands Missile Range, which is south of Socorro. And that test involved a helicopter carrying a Surveyor lunar landing craft. So again, this is early lunar programs before we got to the moon, 64. And so they were wondering, was this a craft from like an early Apollo program moon mission or something like that? They weren't sure. Was that logo he saw on the side, was that from maybe its manufacturer, which was Hughes Aircraft? Were these people in the white coveralls the technicians for this program? But Holloman said they had nothing going on like that at all and that they wouldn't have been there. So they weren't sure, if that's not the case, then what was it? There was a question of whether or not it was a hoax. Hynek said no, because he didn't think that Zamora was the kind of person who would perpetrate a hoax. But there is a theory that it was a hoax from students at a nearby college of the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. And the reason for this theory is because, well, a few things. One is they thought that students may have been upset at this cop for maybe giving out too many tickets, and maybe this was a way to get back at them. So they may have planned this hoax. If this was kids from the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, these are kids who are, technically minded, of course. But there's a document that was sent to the head of the college asking about this case. And he wrote a note back to this other person and said, I have good indication of student who engineered hoax. Student has left. Cheers. And he left his name Sterling. This was the president of the college, Sterling Colgate. So maybe it was an elaborate hoax that was planned by college kids. Possible. Again, that's just one little thing that was found in archives. So again, no good explanation. Lots has been written about this case. A lot of people believe it to be genuine. As I was mentioning at the beginning, I have this amazing photo that's never been published before that came from Project Blue Book's files, where they made a diorama recreating the scene. So you can see the car, you can see Zamora, and you see the egg-like spacecraft or aircraft, and the two figures in white kind of in this sort of ditch off the side of the road.
That's really cool.
And you can
also
see the Project record card in the book, which is straight from Project Blue Book, the actual record card, again, from April 24th, 1964. And it says here, in the comments, it says initially believed to be observation of lunar module type configuration. Effort to date cannot place vehicle at site. Case carried as unidentified pending additional data.
Tell me something about it says he saw this craft and the two people and then he ran off. He was scared that it was going to explode or whatever. How long in between the time that he ran off until the others showed up? Do you know?
I think it was fairly quick. I don't think I have a specific length of time, but I think they came right over there. And it was probably, I don't think it was that far out of town that would have taken people too long to get there.
Yeah, the reason why I'm asking is because, they're talking about some kids pulling off a hoax, man. I mean, that just to me is ridiculous. You would see them packing up their stuff and, just it's crazy to do that.
It does seem a bit far-fetched, even just to be able to pull off so seamlessly and safely.
Right. And without getting caught. I mean, come on. Let me ask you something about what do you know what gave him the idea that it may explode? I thought that was really intriguing. Why would he think that?
I think from the sound and the smoke and probably what he had seen previously, because he saw like a burst of flame. So I think when he heard the sound, saw the flames going, he probably thought, oh, this might blow, like he had sensed early on.
That is really fascinating, actually. Do you know if he was paid visits by anybody from the government, Men in Black, supposedly, anything like that afterwards?
Yeah, the FBI investigated. So he did meet with a lot of people, and like I said, he was believed to be very honest. No one spoke with him and thought like, oh yeah, this guy's full of it. Like they all found him very believable.
Was anybody telling him not to talk about it or to forget that it ever happened? Things like that, warning him off discussing it with the public.
I didn't come across anything like that. He seemed to discuss it pretty freely.
Got you. Great job, man. That is really good. I haven't seen that. Diagram, or you called it what'd you call it?
Diorama.
That's
they
cool.
Built a little diorama. So
yeah, that
diorama.
Is cool.
Yeah.
Okay. The next one I want to talk about is Hopkinsville. Yeah, Hopkinsville incident. Tell us what happened there, because that was portrayed in the Project Blue Book series. That was on the History Channel. They canceled that series. I loved it too, man. I really loved that. But tell us about your research into that incident.
That was a good show. I did enjoy that as well. Hopkinsville is a pretty interesting case. It's a little bit of like probably where Little Green Men came from, the term. This was 1955 in Kelly, Kentucky. So Kelly, Kentucky is just north of Hopkinsville, which is a bit of a bigger town in Kentucky. And this was evening time, August 21st, like I said, 1955. And a guy was with his buddy outside of his farmhouse. Family was inside. And they see this flash of light in the sky. It's a clear sky. And then it looked like a saucer was just kind of swooping down toward the ground and landed in a nearby field. So this guy ran inside, told his buddy and the rest of that family. They were called, their name was the Suttons. He said, hey, this thing just seems to have landed out in the field. Let's go check it out. Of course, they didn't necessarily take him seriously, but then they looked outside. They see this weird, luminescent creature approaching, and it looked like a small man, again, little green man, about 3 feet tall, and it had a large round head, arms that nearly reached the ground. They said it had yellowish eyes, webbed hands with claws. Again, it looked very strange. One of them said it looked like a monkey, but looked like it was made of aluminum foil, was her description. So that's not green, but you get the sense of, like, you know, this kind of image that was being created. So, you know, they see this thing and they're like, what is going on here? They grab their shotguns and they start shooting at it, but nothing happens. And they claim that the bullets bounced off it. They said, quote, like from a concrete pavement. And they claim to have shot it a few times and knocked it to the ground, but he jumped right back up, you know, this creature, and ran off. And then it came back with more. And so more of these creatures start coming up. They're crawling up trees and across the farmhouse roof. Again, this is all what this family is saying. They eventually, got out of there, this family. They were scared. And they raced to the sheriff's office in Hopkinsville, the police station. They said, we need some help. Describe what they see. The cops go back, and of course, they don't see anything. Whatever it was is gone now. But they do say that that the people felt that they were genuinely scared. They didn't seem like they were making up a story for attention. The cop said that he said, quote, something scared those people. That's what he told the press. He said, these aren't the kind of people who normally run to the police for help. When they feel themselves threatened, what they do is reach for their guns. And so he believed that there was something out there that really spooked these people. They just didn't know what it was. There were suggestions that maybe these were escaped monkeys from a nearby circus, although they would have probably not bounced up from bullets. So that doesn't, you know, completely track. So again, this is a pretty bizarre case that, you know, again, if you believe everything that this family said, there's not a good, clear explanation as to what exactly they saw. But, you know, it could have been some sort of creature. And I have this great illustration in the book called The Little Man. And it's, as I described, you know, about 3 feet tall, long, skinny arms reaching toward the ground, kind of big, pointy ears, two big eyes kind of on the sides of its head, a little bit lizard like. So, again, very bizarre. And I've got a great front page headline from the Kentucky New Era newspaper, which says, story of spaceship, 12 little men probed today. Kelly Farmhouse scene of alleged raid by strange crew last night. Reports say bullets failed to affect visitors. So that was, again, front page news in 1955.
Yeah, they shot up their house or whatever, didn't they? I mean, it was bullet riddled.
Well, they were firing the bullets.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They shot up their own home.
Yeah. And, you know, these creatures just seemed to not care about the bullets at all. They were fine.
Now, the drawing here, is that something that they worked with someone to recreate themselves? Or because that's a strange little creature. Did they do that themselves? Or?
This came from a study that was done in 1978 by CUFOS, which is the Center for UFO Studies. That was an organization started by Dr. J. Allen Hynek after Project Blue Book closed in 1969. So he continued investigating UFOs after the Air Force discontinued the program. So, yeah, I think this just came through interviews with the family, this description, the drawing.
That's just amazing. Wouldn't you just love to go back in time and see that go down and watch Hynek? I mean, that's just incredible. The series really brought it to life. I wish that series had continued, but that's one of my favorite episodes is when that happens to that family in Kentucky. So,
yeah, there's so many stories. So many stories could have gone on for so long.
Yeah, it could have gone on just for years. I wished it had of too. I mean, I love that. So do you believe that they truly saw something, or what's your gut telling you about that?
I think they must have seen something. I do think it's weird that they would just start firing their guns and then go to the police station and say, hey, we're firing our guns at something. Like, why would they want to advertise that to the cops unless they were truly worried that something was threatening them? So they must have seen something. Again, you know, was it aliens? We don't know. Possible. Maybe there's other explanations as well. But it's another one of these kind of interesting stories that just doesn't have a definite explanation.
Yeah. What about the UFO you said that they saw hovering above, were there any other reports of neighbors, you know, other neighbors actually seeing the same craft that night, or do you know?
Well, they said it crashed down the field. It came down.
Oh, it came down. Did anybody else see that?
I didn't see anything that said other people witnessed it as well. I think they were kind of just far out, you know, pretty far out in the country.
It looked like they were actually in the woods or something. Like,
I mean, it's just
portrayed by the series, you know, right out in the woods or something.
Yeah.
That's strange. So did they take Hynek? Maybe I missed this. Did Hynek actually go to where they thought they saw the craft crash?
I don't think Hynek personally went to investigate this case. I know we had comments on it. I think someone else went to investigate. I think they did have someone from a nearby Air Force base also look into it. I did note that Project Blue Book didn't officially investigate the case, although Hynek did comment on it. But Major John E. Albert from Fort Campbell, which is about 20 miles south of Hopkinsville, did drive to the scene. And he said he found no evidence to support the story. And then the idea came out later that maybe it was an escaped circus monkey that would have looked like a small man. They supposedly said the circus train was known to be in the area a day earlier. But again, I don't think there were reports of any escaped monkeys. So, again, who knows? Who knows? It's a great story, though.
Yeah, it is. It really is. I want to skip over to David Huggins. I recently saw them talk about him on a series. I think it was on Netflix, maybe. I'm not sure. But tell us about David Huggins and his drawings, because they are really creepy.
Yeah.
Really creepy about his experiences. So, but go ahead.
Yeah. So David Huggins is an experiencer and abductee. Who believed he encountered aliens for the first time in 1951. This was when he was growing up in rural Georgia. He was 8 years old when he said he had his first experience. And he said he was out just, you know, playing by a tree, and he heard a voice say, David, behind you. He turned around, and he saw a little hairy guy with large glowing eyes coming straight toward him. This is something he said in a 2017 documentary called Love and Saucers. And he said he thought it was the boogeyman. He didn't know what to think. He ran to a barn, glanced back, and he saw this little thing kind of run back into the woods. And then over the next few months, he started seeing other things. He said they look like insect-like aliens or the grays. The grays are that sort of popular type of alien with the large gray head and the large eyes, sort of the icon of aliens, if you will. You have an emoji on your phone for it. So he thought he saw some of them as well. And he said that they eventually took him on a spacecraft and inserted a rod into his nose before they brought him back home. And he said he felt like he was tagged like some kind of animal. And then he said, so this went on for years. And he said by the age of 17, he met an extraterrestrial woman. He called her Crescent. And he said that they met under a tree and they had intercourse there. And that was, I guess, his first time having intercourse was with this alien woman. Who basically took his virginity. And this went on and on. So he eventually left Georgia. He moved to New York, and he wanted to pursue a career in art design. And so he escaped this farm in Georgia with all these things that happened there. But he said that the experiences continued in New York, and he would often have dreams where he would see them and feel like he was having experiences. He claimed to have had many relations with Crescent and had, he said he fathered hundreds of alien human hybrid children. And so this was just what he was experiencing. And he said in 1987, so we're fast forwarding a bit, 1987, he read about other people having similar types of experiences with extraterrestrials and sexual acts in a book called Intruders by Bud Hopkins. And I talked about Bud Hopkins in the book, who ran a alien abduction support group in New York City. And so that book had all of his memories flooding back. And then at that point, he decided to start painting his memories. I mentioned he went to New York to study art and pursue art. So he had talents, and he began a series of paintings. I have two of them in the book. One of them shows Crescent taking his virginity. And another one just shows a UFO out in the field in rural Georgia. But they had he painted dozens. I don't know if it's hundreds, but many paintings portraying what he remembered. In some cases, he shows his hybrid babies and him caring for them. And this was just what he's absolutely convinced that this is what happened to him. He didn't go through hypnotic regression to have these memories come back. These were all memories that he had clearly in his head and believed happened.
Very strange. Yeah. Do you know if he's still, is he still alive?
Yeah. Yeah, he is. Yeah. He's someone who I think stays pretty private. He's certainly older now. I was able to speak with a confidant of his, who's very close and owns many of his paintings now. So that was as close as I could get to David Huggins. I don't think he talks to many people at all.
Maybe I can sweet talk him and get him on the show. I don't know. I'll try.
Worth a shot.
Yeah, it is worth a shot. I have to try. That is really creepy, man. It sounds like they had him in some type of involvement with creating hybrids, which is what we hear about quite a bit on the show. Do you believe hybrids are being created?
I struggle a bit to think that there's a whole hybrid program happening. I think the stories are pretty fascinating. I don't doubt that these people believe something happened to them. It's a little hard to imagine that that's what's going on with and being kept so quiet. I feel like that would be more evident by now if it were the case, but that's just me. I mean, I love sharing these stories. I think they're fascinating, but I don't know. It's a tough one to feel convinced about, I guess.
Got you. All right. So now I want to jump over to SETI because you said you were able to talk to some of those people involved in that program. So
SETI, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, really began as an idea back in the late 1950s, early 1960s with a scientist named Frank Drake, who realized that we could use radio telescopes to search for radio signals from other intelligent civilizations elsewhere in the galaxy. And there were a few moments where he actually thought he had a hit. He thought, like, oh my God, I am getting something from, you know, this star system or wherever it might be. But then couldn't replicate it and quickly was able to find a terrestrial explanation. But they were just scratching the surface. And so SETI continued on. It's gone through various forms with, you know, funded from the government for a while and then became funded by donations only. But it continues on and they've got, you know, many radio telescopes now searching the skies and still have barely scratched the surface. The galaxy's universe is just so expansive that, you know, searching every you know, nook and cranny could take, you know, who knows how many years. So they still hope that maybe they'll find something because, like I said, as I said in the book, they basically use like a cup of water from the whole ocean is how they describe how much they've explored thus far. But what I do find really hopeful is that I spoke with Avi Loeb, who runs the Galileo Project, and Avi is the head of the astronomy at Harvard. And he's the guy who, if you remember in 2017, there was an interstellar object that passed through the solar system, which was called Oumuamua. And Avi Loeb is the scientist who suggested that might be extraterrestrial technology passing through the solar system. So what he's looking for now, he's now got funding, you know, lots of private donations coming in. He's got clout. He's got obviously the know-how. And because he's got all that, he's got about 100 scientists working with him on what he calls the Galileo Project. And so they're searching the skies for to collect its own data, not relying on government data. As he says, you know, the skies are not classified. So he can collect his own data now and start to try and find answers. Like, are there other interstellar objects passing through? Can we catch them in time now to photograph them and learn more about them? Might UAPs be something extraterrestrial? Again, the data we have from those are so transient, they're so fleeting. But if we're looking for them more, we have the tools and resources, hopefully we can get the data to actually understand something better. So I find a lot of hope in what he's doing. And I know he's got some people from SETI advising and working with him, which I also find promising that they're putting their brains together. They've got so much knowledge between those groups that they should be working together and try to find some answers. What are people seeing? And those answers may very well prove to be extraterrestrial, which would be fascinating, incredibly exciting. On the other hand, they might be something terrestrial. They might be something new about physics that we didn't know before. This has happened before where we learn something new about physics to explain sightings people had had in the skies. And that would also be exciting. You know, there's plenty that we don't know. I think that we're short-sighted if we think we know everything one way or the other. So I think it's great that's being explored seriously now, but I think for the first time, really.
I saw a lot of headlines with Avi. Did he believe that we'd been visited by extraterrestrial life, or what was his take on that? Do you know?
Yeah, I think he believes that this is extraterrestrial technology going through. It may be old. It could be remnants from a civilization. But he also acknowledged, and I think I have a quote or two in the book about this, that we don't know that for sure. Like, we may find something passing through the solar system, and we'd have to be careful how we react to it, because what if there is something aboard, or there could even be AI aboard that could affect us in some way. You know, they may have their own artificial intelligence system aboard. I mean, think about the fact that we have, I mentioned earlier, we've got, you know, robots on Mars. Who's to say that, you know, there's no, you know, humans with those, right? It's just all controlled from here. So who's to say something that might pass through might not be controlled by someone elsewhere with no beings aboard it. So he's looking at all those possibilities. And I think he looks at, like, we need to be prepared one way or the other for what this could be. So he's very open-minded, which is what you need to be to study this.
Oh, you have to be. You have to be. Did he actually recover? I need to see if I can get him on the show. Did he recover something at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean that he believed came from another planet?
Did.
Or you know anything about that? If you do, tell us about it.
I know a little bit. This actually happened after we spoke. I speak with him. It was like New Year's Eve, I think, of 2021, if I remember correctly. So since then, I know he did recover something that he believed was another interstellar object that had crashed into the ocean and recovered it. And I forgot if he actually confirmed that there was something extraterrestrial nature about it or not, but that's certainly quite Googleable. I'm sure you can find something about that. But yeah, I mean, what I love, though, is that he's continuing to pursue it and make noise about it, keep people interested about it, keep people talking about it, and gathering other scientists to look into it with him. The more resources, the more chances we have to find something out.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into that and really try to see if I can't get him on the show. Mark, your book is great, man. I'm going to be buying a bunch of these and giving them away to my listeners. I want you to tell them where they can keep up with you or any other projects you may be working on.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. So you can follow me on Instagram. I'm at Mark Hartzman. That's Mark, MarkHartzman. Also, same handle on Twitter. I have a website called weirdhistorian.com. And you can follow my book projects at markhartzmanbooks.com. And the book's available everywhere. You can go on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookshop. And please pick it up. It's full of images, documents, things that have never been published before, all kinds of amazing stories. And if you like it, I hope you leave a review. And I am working on a new book now, which I think you'll like talking to me about later once it comes out, about all kinds of secret government projects that have, not secret anymore, declassified, but a lot of really strange, bizarre projects, which will include some more UFO stuff as well.
That is awesome. The book, again, is called We Are Not Alone, The Extraordinary History of UFOs and Aliens, Invading Our Hopes, Fears, and Fantasies. It is available everywhere. I picked it up off of Amazon. I'll probably be buying probably 20 more copies of that, Mark, to give those away. And Mark, you are on like TikTok. Are you on TikTok? I could have swore I followed you on TikTok.
I am on TikTok. I haven't done a whole lot. That's kind of new for me. But yeah, I'm just at Mark Hartzman on TikTok.
Got you. All right. You're welcome. Mark Hartzman, my special guest. Mark, many blessings to you, and I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
To find out more about our guest and all others, please visit our website at mysteriousradio.com. And I want to give special thanks to our co-creator and executive producer, Kim Kyle, who brought this show to you today. And working hard behind the scenes, our team of four, I want to thank them as well. Follow us on social media and share the show with others that may like the subjects that we cover. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio.